When it comes to the birth of the nation, the Pilgrims have usually been given most of the credit, even though they landed at Plymouth Rock some 13 years after Captain John Smith and company came ashore at Jamestown. Jamestown's problem is that historians have pegged it as badly organized and peopled with quarrelsome and sometimes riotous settlers. This is contrasted with the reputation of the Pilgrims as prim, pious, and family-centered. I'm Sarah McConnell with New Perspectives on Jamestown. Today, three historians give us a captivating new view of America's first permanent English settlement. My guests today say Jamestown's early terrible reputation is misleading. History professor Karen Kupperman of New York University says Jamestown had a tough time because it was first. It had to figure out how to create a working society and government through trial and error. And written accounts of Jamestown's experiences actually became a guide for the Plymouth colony. Along with Karen Kupperman, joining in today's discussion are historian Jim Wittenberg of the College of William & Mary, and Randy Shiflett, a professor of history at Virginia Tech and director of Virtual Jamestown. Karen, let me start with you. Jamestown was settled before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth. So why do American history books spend more ink on Plymouth than Jamestown?
Well, I think there's two ways of answering that question. One has to do with the 17th century, and the other has to do with the 19th century, when the history books were actually written. All the reports from Jamestown in the early years were of disorder, distress, disaster, food shortages, apparent inability to cope. And those have been taken by historians to be transparent representations of what really happened, whereas I think they are really charges and countercharges by factions in the colony, all trying to explain why things aren't going the way they thought they should. If you were a historian who was writing a history of the first decade of the 20th century, and somebody said, okay, here are the sources. The sources are all the television commercials from the last presidential campaign, and that's basically it. Go and write a history of this 10-year period. You know, that's what the Jamestown sources look like. It's people painting each other in the worst possible light as a way of explaining why things haven't gone as they hoped they would go. So what looks like disorder and despair and licentiousness is actually a process of figuring out how to do this. And once they get it figured out, then it's easy for the later colonies to emulate that.
So that is the 17th century version. What's the other?
Well, the other is that in the early national period, after the Revolutionary War and the Constitution went into effect, one of the things that the New Englanders do, essentially, is take control of the founding period. They use this reputation of Jamestown as a place of disorder and despair, and then they create, essentially, this version of history centered around the Pilgrims. The words Pilgrim Fathers weren't even used before 1799. That all is part of this process of creating this alternative founding story in which you have superior people with superior motives founding a colony in New England, which then becomes the symbolic true beginning of American history. And Jamestown is sort of assigned to some nether region in this scheme. And this then is intensified throughout the 19th century. I mean, part of the short answer is that all the publishing industry was in New England, in Boston and in Connecticut. And so there, all the textbooks that were published were basically published there and spread throughout the country.
Jim Wittenberg, what's your take on this?
Right. We're looking for a model of American development in the 19th and 20th century. That is, what is America based on? Well, that can't be Virginia. That can't be the place where slavery began. That can't be the place that was the capital of the Confederacy. So, especially in the late 19th century, it's got to be something else. Well, that looks like that probably ought to be New England. So New England in the textbook sort of marches across the continent. The New England way becomes the Midwestern way.
I also have the feeling, I don't know whether Jim and Randy would agree with this, but that the Virginians themselves kind of have the feeling that it's better not to talk about Jamestown. You know, that because Jamestown was derelict, and people kind of, I think, in the South as well as the North, accepted the idea that it's too shameful to really talk about.
Yeah, and there was, as you pointed out earlier, Karen, there was so much that had to be learned and understood. And this was, they were working out things at Jamestown that I'm sure they later would have made different decisions and done things differently had they have had the benefit of that experience to borrow upon, as the New Englanders did with the Virginians.
Do we know that the Virginia Company in England actually founded the Plymouth Colony by studying the mistakes that it had made in Virginia and consciously avoiding those?
Well, my answer is yes. Captain John Smith turned his attention to New England in 1614, and in fact, he coined the name New England, I think, in order to indicate that in New England, you could live as an English person, whereas in Virginia, with its hot climate, people went mad, you know. So he spent the rest of his life really writing about the theory and practice of colonization. And I think it's very clear that at least Edward Winslow, who was the second in command at Plymouth, had read John Smith.
Jim, talk to us about just how different the makeup of the individuals of the two colonies was. In 1607, and for the first few years, what were the ages and genders of the people at Jamestown?
The people who came to early Virginia were predominantly male, predominantly young. They did not come typically as families, though there were married couples. In New England, they did come as families, sometimes whole communities. They had a much more normal age structure, a perfectly normal sex ratio. Family formation was easy. In Virginia, it was virtually impossible until near the end of the century to have a normal family life. The Virginians had a curious pattern that was not all that uncommon, where by the time the youngest child in a family reaches his or her majority, neither parent is the biological parent.
First, what does that mean?
Well, first one parent dies and then remarries, and then the other biological parent dies and remarries. So, as Smith said, to live in an English way, just the passage of wealth from one generation to another becomes very tricky, and Virginians become very concerned with laws about caring for orphans, for example.
Tell me about the difference in life expectancy for Virginians and the first colonists of Massachusetts.
It's about 20 years. Men in the Chesapeake could expect to live to about 40 if they survive to adulthood, and in New England they can live into their 60s or even longer. And women in the Chesapeake aren't going to make it to 40. Their life expectancy is 38 or 39, and again, in New England it's perfectly normal or even better than Old England. So there's a good 20 years difference in life expectancy.
What was happening to the Virginians? Who was killing them?
We think it was malaria, which became endemic. There was a form of malaria actually in the Fen countries in England that was not a particularly deadly form, but weakened people. And then when they began to import people from Africa, they also then received this much deadlier form of malaria that was endemic in Africa.
I think this is a good place for a pause. We're talking about the Jamestown Colony, founded in Virginia in 1607. My guests are three experts in this field: Karen Kupperman of New York University, Jim Wittenberg of the College of William and Mary, and Randy Shiflett of Virginia Tech. We were talking earlier about Virginians themselves being embarrassed about some of the Jamestown fiascos. Jim, what were the early embarrassments?
Well, overall, it's mismanagement by the company. I mean, you can look at 1624 when the company is dissolved. It's done through a legal process. It's more or less put on trial. And the overall charge is that the company mismanaged Virginia and failed to protect the English settlers.
The first colony consisted of is it 107 men and boys? And at the end of that first winter, there were 38 people alive.
Yes.
So that's one of the great emblematic statements. And in the second one, the starving time, which was the winter of 1609-10, after Smith had left the colony, they went from several hundred colonists down to 60. So those are the two great emblematic moments in early Virginia history where you can say this is a disaster.
Shouldn't it have been difficult to find more colonists to ship over there after that kind of attrition rate?
Well, they found unwilling colonists at times. I mean,
did they?
Yeah, sure. Kids in orphanages in London, the company bought up orphanages to send kids over here. They sent prisoners, prison labor over here. But I don't think the sort of people who wound up in Virginia tobacco fields were that knowledgeable about what Virginia was like when they were in England.
So did some people come over here because they thought, I'm really going to make it big?
Oh, no, certainly.
Well, I think they came not, I'm going to make it big, but thinking, I'm going to get my stake. I'm going to be able to have my 50 acres and establish a family on that land.
Why do you say 50 acres?
Well, that was what they were promised in the early days. You could invest in purse or you could invest your own self in the venture, and investors got 50 acres.
This is comparable to the freedman's dream after the American Civil War, where former slaves believed that they were going to get 40 acres and a mule. This is a comparable kind of understanding on the part of the indentured servants that once they work out their indenture, they will get their stake in Virginia society.
And did they typically get their 50 acres?
Some did. Many did not. Many were cheated out of it. Many had their contracts renewed and never saw their 40 acres.
And a lot didn't survive.
Amen.
To get
Amen.
It, you know. The death rate was very high for newcomers.
A very large percentage of the Virginia population isn't able to realize this dream, and it leads toward the end of the century to a great deal of social upheaval, of which Bacon's Rebellion is the most outstanding example in 1676.
Randy, we think of the Puritan mission as almost exclusively religious. How much of the Jamestown venture had a religious component? Was there a religious component from the get-go?
Well, sure. I mean, there was a sense that they had a mission to spread Protestant religion in Virginia.
But I thought the Virginia Company, which financed this effort, was more like a group of investment bankers looking for a return on their money.
Well, certainly it was, and that's the reason I say that we need to look at that as their priority. But that should not call into question the sincerity of Englishmen who felt that religion was important in the colony.
Well, we have companies in 20th century America that have a moral agenda as well as a financial agenda, and I think that's what this was. The whole British venture into the New World, one of its major components is the sense that it can free the New World from the Catholic Spanish yoke. And they were sincere about this. If that qualifies as religious motivation, it's religious imperialist motivation, but they were very sincere about it.
You know, as my students would put it, people went to Virginia to make money and they went to New England for religion. But it's the Pilgrim second in command, Edward Winslow, who said, in America, religion and profit jump together. And he meant that if you're doing right, then God will reward you. And I think that's a very common theory. I don't think they would have seen a dichotomy in this.
Randy Shiflett?
We don't associate Puritanism with Virginia, despite the fact that one of the eminent historians of New England, Perry Miller, once made the comment that the Virginia laws on religion matched anything in Puritan society. Mm-hmm. And there were Puritan settlements in Virginia as early as 1618.
You know, the Pilgrims had 50 Puritans in their company. And what Randy is referring to is a migration of several hundred separatists who went from the Netherlands to Virginia. And those have pretty much been written out of the record, too.
So what did the colonists discover in terms of religion and spirituality and belief sets on the part of the Indians when they arrived in Virginia. What had they known before they arrived about what these people believed, given that they intended to convert them to Christianity?
Thomas Harriot, who was in Roanoke, which was 20 years before Jamestown, had learned the coastal Carolina Algonquian language before he went, and he said, the Indians have the footprints of religion, and it will make it that much easier for them to accept Christianity.
Some of them, like Pocahontas, were famously converted, but did the Indians in general ever really buy into the religion of the English?
I would say not. There were converts, but I think on the whole the Indians resisted English efforts to convert them in Virginia.
Did the traditional Christian creation story and the Indian creation story have anything in common?
Neither one of them, of course, is a completely straightforward story. And there is this incident in which Henry Spelman, who was one of these young boys left with Indians, including the leader Yapazus, who lived up on the Potomac. An English ship came into the Potomac, and one of the men was reading the Bible. And so, and Yapazus said he would like to know what the book said. And so the captain took the book, turned it to a picture of the creation of the world, and told Spelman to explain this picture to Yapazus. We don't know what he said, but then Yapazus said, I will now tell you my people's creation story. And it Yapazus said that there had originally been five gods, the four winds and a mighty great hare, and that the four winds each ruled one section of the world. Then the hare made people, but put them in a great bag. And then the hare went on to make the water and the land and stocked the water with fish and put deer on the land. And then the men and women he took out of the bag and placed them upon the earth, and each area received one couple. So this is what the people in Jamestown knew of an Indian creation story.
So how customary in particular was Henry Spelman's position? Here was a man who was planted by the first arriving colonists in an Indian village at the age of 13. Were there others like him?
It was very common.
Mm-hmm. Was it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things about it is that they never trusted these people. They relied on them utterly.
The English didn't trust their moles?
That's right, because they had some divided consciousness. And Henry Spelman was actually tried and convicted of treason at the meeting of the First Assembly in 1619 because they thought he was favoring the Indians' point of view over the English.
Why did the Indians accept these boys to live among them?
Well, there was a reciprocal exchange here. Usually the Indians placed one of theirs in with the English.
This is how Pocahontas winds up in Jamestown. So if you have your favorite daughter living among the English, this might have some influence on your behavior toward the English.
But I think what it means is that there were real bonds of affection forged by these children on both sides. And it's clear that these Indian leaders who accepted English boys had real affection for those boys, thought of them as their sons.
Other reasons why the English would be very wary of moles as well. There were settlers who were abandoning Jamestown and James Fort, especially in the early period, and going to live with the Indians and not coming back. The English knew this and were concerned about it.
You know, over the course of colonial history, there's a significant number of English men and women and children who, having been captured by the Native Americans and taken into their communities, made part of that. Even when they're given the opportunity to return to white society, they decide not to do it. They find things that they like among the Native Americans.
I think this is a good time to bring in the Indian perspective and the relationship between the English and the Indians. And I can't think of a better way of getting to that than talking about the conversation that ensued, according to John Smith, between Powhatan and himself when he was trying to trade with the Powhatans for food, when he said, "Captain Smith, I'm the last living relative of three generations here. I know more than any of my countrymen about peace and war. Think you not that I would rather eat meat, sleep in peace at night, and enjoy my friends and make merry with you rather than be hunted by you and have to go lie cold in the woods at night and live on acorns and roots and other trash?" He goes on to explain to John Smith how much better both of them would be off if they could live in peace and trade for, as he said, our copper, our hatchets, and other things that I need, and you could rely on me for the food that you don't know how to find. It speaks to the whole ignorance, I guess, is the best way of putting, that the English had of the environment in which they found themselves. They need to rely on the Indians and are unwilling to do so because they come with this understanding of the Indians as an inferior people.
John Smith wrote extensively about his explorations in Virginia, looking for gold, looking for profit for the Virginia Company, and also his encounters with Indians. Randy, tell us about the encounter he had with one Monacan Indian, where he was asking, "Who do your people think we are?"
This was a conversation he had with the Monacan Indian by the name of Amarolik. And the response of Amarolik was, "We think your people are from the underworld who've come to take us." Amarolik was saying, "We think you're some people from the dead, from the netherworld, who've come to take our world from us."
Let me move away from religion a little bit and ask you this. In some ways, the American dream, you might say, began in Virginia, thanks to what you called the headright system, this notion, at least, that you would give people 50 acres after a period of indenture servitude. How did that proceed through time? What did that evolve into in terms of our understanding of how you could get ahead in Virginia and therefore America?
I think it's a mistake to say that American dream begins at Jamestown. You can see it at Jamestown, but it begins all over the place. It begins in New England, begins in the Middle Atlantic. But you can see it operating very clearly in Jamestown, where you can start with nothing and achieve something.
What else about Jamestown early on became the precursor to a form of government, democratic ideals? What in the early years of Jamestown were the seeds of those ideals?
To find any place that's really democratic in the modern sense of democracy in the 17th century, I don't think that's possible. The notion of a participatory democracy like we have now is just not there in the 17th century. I don't think anyone wanted what they would call the mob to speak for them, even the mob. They wanted great men, important men.
But they do pass laws. I think that establishes an important tradition. They do begin to say that this is a society of law, and that very act, I think, is important in the early colony.
Well, and I think one of the important things that happens in the first meeting of the assembly or with the institution of the assembly is control of taxation. People had to contribute so many hours a month to the public works, the roads and the fortifications and other things. But they wanted to be able to impose those levies themselves, and the two go together. You can't, there's no point in having private property without control of taxation, in their view.
I'm trying to get an accurate understanding of Jamestown's legacy. Is it too much to say that the shape of present-day America had its beginnings, at least, at Jamestown?
I think it's a problematic question because we often do it feeds into the linear view of history that we move from Jamestown ever forward and keep making continuous progress as we go along and build on the past and learn from it. I'm not certain that the legacy of Jamestown ought to be understood in that kind of way, but understood more in terms of where they were at the time, what they understood, what they thought they were doing, and what they did out of ignorance and misunderstanding of the society in which they lived. We can then see the things that they did in more positive ways, such as the General Assembly and its seeding of the idea of representation and control over taxation by the people in these other kinds of ways. But that's not linear. I mean, that understanding, that view of government has some rough spots before we get to the American Revolution.
Karen?
We have to also acknowledge that this principle of ownership of land then was extended to ownership of labor after the middle of the 17th century. And the legacy, you know, sort of bifurcates in a way, because that's a legacy that we wish had not happened. But it's the same principle, I think, that you have a right to control your own production. And so, therefore, in a sense, the seeds of it are there from the beginning, I think.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. The legacy of Jamestown, legacy of early Virginia, it's all intertwined with tobacco, the decision to use massive amounts of unfree labor, the importation of kidnapped Africans, and the way that all intertwines. That's still, if you pick out one thing from early Virginia, that matrix is still a dominant factor in 20th century American life.
We had to learn to be democratic and tolerant and diverse. It didn't just fall out of the sky. And we must see history, it seems to me, as process, where that's a part of the process, and that it's not always linear. It's up and down, back and forth, some winning and losing.
Well, Randy Shiflett, Jim Wittenberg, and Karen Kupperman, I'm so pleased to have had this Jamestown Brain Trust here to help us update our image of Jamestown on the eve of the 2007 commemoration of its founding.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Karen Kupperman is a history professor at New York University and a leading scholar of the Atlantic world in the 16th and 17th centuries. Jim Wittenberg is a professor of history at the College of William and Mary. Randy Shiflett's a history professor at Virginia Tech and director of Virtual Jamestown. New Perspectives on Jamestown is a production of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and was produced with the generous support of the Rosenstiel Foundation. Elliot Majerzik and Jesse Dukes are our associate producers. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. Nancy King creates our features. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. And Lydia Wilson is our publicity coordinator. For a free copy of this show on CD or to comment, call 877-451-5098. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.